All right, so good morning. I know it's pretty early. It's Wednesday. You're halfway there, halfway through tech ed, halfway to being the smartest person back in your shop back home. But before you do that, I want to get you prepped for the 7483 C-sharp exam. So normally we do a little slide where we say about me and stuff like this, but today is not really about me. It's about you as attendees. If you're in here, you've probably been thinking about getting a developer certification. You've probably been, this echoes. Is it bad to anybody else? Okay. I'm losing my mind. All right. Too early in the morning. It's really about you. So the idea here is that you're thinking about taking an exam, you're thinking about getting a developer certification, and this is the last mile. So unfortunately, I will not teach you C sharp in an hour and 15 minutes. Can't do it. I like to think I'm a good trainer. I'm not that good. However, I'm going to run through some objectives domains, and you're going to see them on the Microsoft Learning website for this exam. We'll talk about this in a little bit more detail. But if I say anything in this next hour or 15 minutes that you've never heard of before, write it down. You now have a list of things that you need to go back and say, let me at least try this once. How many people learn C sharp in an academic environment? Okay, how many people learn C sharp on a job? All right, so I had the benefit of learning C sharp in college. So I was taught the language spec. I was taught all the idiosyncratic language features, and then I used it in practice. But most people, that's not how you ended up in C sharp. So there's a lot of language features you probably never even explored or wasn't even aware of. And that's really what we're going to look at today. So let's get started. All right, so three objectives here today. First off, I'm going to kind of set the table. I'm not going to spend too long on this, but just talk about certifications in general. Where does 7483, 483, fit into the overall certification picture? Then we're going to talk about the objective domain. That's the list of things that the exam will test you on and what those are. And once we define them, we'll just actually go into the objective domains. I have on here that we're going to review a selection of topics, but I've actually decided sometime late last night in hysteria that we're going to try and hit all the objective domains today. So we're going to try and move fast, but I don't know. Never tried this before, so let's see what happens. So first, let's talk about certifications in general. Real easy, certifications are good for you, good for your career. The biggest thing is just increase your level of confidence. You go in there, I don't know how many cert exams you may have passed up until now, but every time I pass a cert exam, especially one when I thought I was going to fail, just makes me feel a little bit better. I go back and say, all right, I actually know a little bit more than I thought I knew. But the biggest thing is the second bullet point, enhance product knowledge. So studying for the cert exam itself enhances your knowledge of a product. So I used to have a manager when I went after my first MCP credential. It was the data access exam for Visual Studio 2010. That was a pain. I failed it twice. I think a 685 out of 700 needed the first time. Then went in and failed it with like a 670 something. And then I passed it with 705 and I wanted to print out my score report real quick before they changed their mind. But I had a really good manager. And every time I failed, I went back to my manager and said, I came close. And he said, well, did you learn anything studying for it? I said, yeah. Okay, that was worth the money itself. The exam cost nothing compared to the cost of training and the amount of studying you did to prep for that exam. That's just worth it in and of itself. Now, on the career side, it's a big differentiator. We all have review processes where we work. Maybe your job doesn't have that, but when you stand next to another candidate, maybe for a new position or for a promotion or just, at your annual review, a certification is just something real easy, real measurable that can differentiate you from your competition. If you're in the job market or if you've been in the job market recently, you know a lot of organizations that use software to scan your resumes, to process your resumes. The HR department looks at your resume, and then they filter out resumes before it even gets to the technical people at the job, right? So if you have a certification, that says to somebody non-technical, okay, this person might know a little bit more than I think they do, and it'll get you to the next step, to the actual person who knows the subject matter and will actually be able to interview you effectively. So any differentiator on your resume is extremely effective, especially with all the automated hiring and the automated resume processing going on nowadays. Like I said, I'm not going to spend too long on this. So we have new MCSE, MCSD certifications. If you've been around for a while, you know those have been, we're just reusing acronyms that used to be around. It used to be MCSD and MCSE. Then we went to MCPD and a whole bunch of them for the IT pro side, a lot of acronyms. And then we just came back to MCSE and MCSD. So I would imagine since you're in a developer session, you probably only really care about developer ones. So we got a couple of interests. 7483 gets you on the track to quite a few certifications. To start, it gets you on the track to the web applications MCSD. You combine that with the ASP.NET MVC4 exam and the web services Microsoft Azure exam, then that's the MCSD and web applications. If you're interested in Windows Store, programming C# is the fundamental right there. And of course, we have other MCSDs. We have the Windows Store for HTML5 variant. We have the SharePoint apps one. If you actually earn your MCSD in web applications, you're only two exams away from getting it in SharePoint apps, too. So that's something, you know, a lot of people don't pick up on, pointing out, like, oh, that's pretty convenient. And then, of course, we have the MCSD in application lifecycle management. All right, the exams themselves, they're trying to make the exams reflect the real world a whole lot more than in the past. So it's all about learning more, validating what you learned. So there's two groups of people that come into the certification exam. There's the people who actually work with the product on a day-to-day basis. They're just trying to fill any gaps in their knowledge. And those are the type of people we want certified, people who actually work with the product, who are really good with the product. And then there's people who just study, or maybe they'll cram from a legal side, or maybe, you know, people who don't really work with the product every day. So you want the test, as somebody who may pass the test, you want the test to be hard for people who don't work with it every day and easy for people who do work with it every day. Anybody disagree with that? So they try to make the test reflect that. So they try to come up with questions and solutions and case studies that reflect things you do in practice. So if you work with the product every day, you can probably infer the answer. Whereas somebody who doesn't work with the product every day, they may get confused because there's not three obviously incorrect answers and one correct answer. So again, this makes the test a little bit more rigorous than it's been in the past. Now, the other side of that is we have less multiple choice questions. Multiple choice questions, and this is opinion alert, benefits people who just study for the test. People who actually work in the industry, you actually benefit from other types of questions, questions where case studies, questions where you have to actually look at a screen and say, well, which part of the screen do you click to do this feature? Well, if you work with the product every day, it's pretty easy to know where you click on the properties window. Whereas somebody who doesn't work with the product every day, it may be difficult for them to study. And so we're seeing less and less multiple choice questions and a lot more alternative questions. And these are new, they call it the innovative item types. You can always go to Microsoft Learning's website, and they actually have examples of all the new item types. And I'm a big fan. You can always check them out. There's a lot of really interesting ones. There's ones where you complete code using drop-down lists. So they'll give you a block of code, and three items are missing. And from the drop-down list, you pick the right maybe properties or class names. So a lot of different item types that, again, they benefit people who work with the product every day. All right. Quick tips for the exam. Then I promise I'll get past the boring part real quick. 40-60 questions on average. You get about, depending on upon the exam, about 1 hour to 4 hours. And this exam, I believe, is 3 hours you get to complete this exam. You can review questions, but the test is broken up into what's called, forgive me if it's this term, or modulates, or modules. And so if you have a case study, that's a module. Your multiple choice questions, all of them grouped together as a module. So when you're done with a module, you can move to the next module, but you can't go back to that module. So an example, let's say you start off with a case study with 10 questions, right? Once you're done with those 10 questions, you decide to move beyond the case study, you're done. You can't go back to that case study. Then you may get 20 multiple choice questions. You can go back and forth between all those multiple choice questions, but when you're done with that module, you're done, and then maybe you'll get a case study at the end. So three different modules, that's just an example. Depending upon the time of day, what side of bed you woke up on in the morning, your test layout may be completely, drastically different. 700 is passing, but 700 is not 70%. They actually measure this score based upon the beta results. They look at the beta results, look at how people do. They look at their objectives. How much do they want you to accomplish in order to be certified? as a specialist in programming in C#, and then they come up with a baseline for 700. So when you read a question on exam, all questions have a consistent anatomy. That means the people who actually work on exams, they have a structure they have to use for all exam questions. First off, they start off with the business problem. So they're going to describe a little bit of context, you know, set the table for you. So they may say, you know, we have the Contoso website, or we have this business scenario. And then they start to give you a little bit of that context. And then they hit you with the goal statement. So the goal statement is just very clearly, very succinctly, typically one sentence, what are we trying to accomplish? So you get a little bit of context. Remember, that context is important. Because if you're talking about the answer to a specific solution in C#, the context could change. Now, once you get that goal, one or more correct answers. Now, even among the multiple choice questions, many of them are multiple choice questions which allow you to select multiple answers. And some of them even have multiple answers that compose a single correct solution. So again, one or multiple correct answers. And then distractors. The distractors are for the people who don't work in the product every day. So they're things that catch their eye. They're like, oh, that sounds cool. You've probably seen it to any exam, probably exams in high school, exams throughout your life. You've probably seen a distractor and you say, now that's obviously wrong, but I'm sure somebody's going to click that because it looks right. But I know that doesn't exist at all. So that's the distractors. But the key thing here is that they're not trying to trick anybody with questions. Questions that look like they're trying to trick you are tossed in review. So the question is not to trick you. The question is to be very clear and concise on what they're trying to do. That goal statement, you won't. Now that I told you to structure a question, you're going to start noticing it if you ever sit an exam again. You're going to see a sentence, you go, that's the goal. Okay. They're designed to be very clear and concise. All right. So let's talk about study resources real quick. So we have a web page on Microsoft Learning. You don't have to write this down. You can always just go to Microsoft.com/learning and look up the exam by exam number. And every exam has this page. And they tell you there's two main sections of this page that you'd be interested in. One is the skills measured section. It breaks down by percentage multiple sections, typically four, that comprise the exam. And the idea here is that maybe 25% exam is this content and 25% exam is that content. I'm being very vague on purpose right now because I'm going to show you it for this exam in a couple slides. And then we have preparation options, which I think is critical. Now, the preparation options, it just goes through some of the options you have available that a lot of people I've found, you know, talking to people tech ed, don't even know are on the Microsoft Learning website. For instance, it'll talk to you about, well, what training could you go to? Let's say your organization has vouchers for training. What instructor-led training could you do? There's an exam prep video. There is one for 7483 where there's two evangelists sitting down, and they're actually talking about the exam. So this is actually very similar to this session, so just a little bit of a different twist. So if you want to do that, that's actually a link right there to that video. And then community links. There's links to wikis, there's links to forums where we actually talk about these exams and talk about prepping for these exams. And people help each other out on the Born to Learn forums. And they have hyperlinks to those. They even have a link to the Microsoft Press book if you are interested in that. So when you go to the Microsoft Learning website, and this is just an example, I'm showing you the one for 483, but this is how all exams are structured. You'll see skills measured. It'll tell you the different sections. Don't worry about if you don't get this down. We're going to look at this in more detail. But it breaks each section down, what percentage you should see on this exam. And then underneath those, it has different bullets. And you're guaranteed at least one question for each bullet. So again, it's a really good checklist. So if you're like me, you know, I like to be as complete as possible. I usually print that list off, put it on paper, and start going through it. What do I know? What do I don't know? And now I have a checklist of what to study. And I do this for all exams. I just passed the HTML5 and Windows Store Essentials exam yesterday, and that's how I did it, because I had no idea what to study for that exam, because I worked with the platform, but I was lost. So printing that out helped me out, and I knew the couple things that I just didn't use in practice that I really need to understand in order to be successful. All right, jump starts. Microsoft Virtual Academy. Anybody never used Microsoft Virtual Academy before? All right, I will make believers out of you. Microsoft Virtual Academy, free, free, free. That can't say it enough. Online training, videos, evangelists, MCTs, industry leaders, sitting down talking to you about different topics. They have a jump start. That's a long form video talking about the content in this, in both the course and the exam. So the programming is C# Jumpstart, and these slides will be available to you, you know, after the session, if you want to click on those links. That Jumpstart is right there on Microsoft Virtual Academy. Just go to the homepage, search C#. They even have C# fundamentals for absolute beginners. So maybe you've never worked with C# before, maybe you're coming from VB. That's a good place to start so that you get the most out of the programming in C# Jumpstart, because it does make a couple assumptions about your experience level. And finally, there is exam reference. You're able to purchase this. O'Reilly in the study hall is offering 30 days access to Safari eBooks, so they actually have other books that are available. So, you know, hint, hint, go to the study hall if you want to find out the most amount of, find the most amount of books you can at this conference. And like I said, I promised I'd go through the boring stuff fast. All right, let's go into what everybody came here for. Let's talk about what's on the exam itself. So everything was really close to 25%, so I don't even know why I bothered with a pie chart. I could have just faked it and just put like four sections. All right, so there's four main content areas, and we're actually going through each one individually. We're going to use a special tool today. Anybody ever used LinkPad before? All right. Well, I'm going to use LinkPad when I talk about some of the features. There's a couple features, language features I'm going to talk about. I'm going to use LinkPad to just give you some examples of probably control statements in C#. It's part of language spec that's listed on this objective domain that you probably never used before because you never really had to. But again, you want to know to be successful. So there's four main topics. Come on. All right. So we're going to start with managing program flow, so control statements. I'm talking about asynchronous. And then we're going to go into types. Just, again, really simple if you work with C#, but the slide might have one thing listed out of the six bullet points. You say, I've never worked with that before. That's what this is here for, like the last minute health checkup. And then we're going to go to two smaller areas where we're just talking about debug applications, trace statements, a little bit about security, and then finally data access. And we're just going to go, if we have enough time left, we're going to go wild there. All right, so the first section, then this takes up about 26% of the exam, is managing program flow. And there's four main bullets you'll see, well, five actually, that you'll see in there, and I have a slide for each. So first off, asynchronous processing. If you haven't used the async await keywords, use them. Go play with them. It's expected of you to understand this. It's listed in the objective domain for the exam, so you guarantee the minimum one question on this. But it's something you haven't tested before, then it's worth your time to go check out. Specifically, and this is the one that people ask me, I know async await, but what else do I need to study? You should probably take a step back and go look at the task parallel library. Now, this is being used underneath the hood by these keywords because they're syntactical sugar, really. And we're going to look at an example of this. But it's not enough to just be able to magically use the async await keywords. And if somebody asks you how it works, oh, it's magic. Like, for example, anybody knows when you use the await keyword, the code that comes after the await keyword, what is going on underneath the hood? Anybody have a clue? Starts a task. But there's a task parallel library implementation. Did everybody know that all the code beyond the await keyword is ran in a task.continueif? That's one thing that I kind of assumed, but I never really looked into too deeply other than a year or two ago, and I said, that's actually pretty interesting. So if you're not familiar with the task parallel library that predated async await, then you're going to be a little bit confused with some of the concepts, because that's actually what it was all built on top of. So let's look at an example of this. All right, so I'm gonna jump. I use LinkPad because I think it's just real easy tool to just test things out. Like you have an immediate window. It's really like I always say it's like a console for C#. So let's start with the simplest.
Whoa.
I apologize about the rambling. So I have an integer I'm going to call a value. And I'm going to do some long-running operation to find out what the value this is. So you've probably seen this in a lot of examples. People call task.run, and they create a Lambda-style delegate, or if you're familiar with old-school delegates, you can do it that way, too. It's good to know that you can do it both ways. You'd be surprised. Some people new to C-sharp only know how to do it in the Lambda syntax, don't know how to actually type in the delegate keyword. Now, we can run this task, and I'm going to long-running logic, dot, 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 and then return 3 plus 4. But it's going to fail. Oh, not for that reason. So that task method actually returns a task, a generic task. I wanted to get mic'd up because I suck at micing myself up. All right, so it returns a generic task of type integer. And then we can use the await keyword to essentially run that task in the background. And then we call this process unwrapping the task to get that value back. So if we do await, what's really going on underneath the hood, and I'll run it so you can see it works, I'm not crazy. What's really going on underneath the hood is we're calling task integer some compiler value, because we don't know what this is. This is all the magic happening behind the scenes. Task.run. And then I'm going to, you know what, I'm going to clear this up even more. Da, da, da. I'm going to figure out int. I'm going to create a method. Because this is all the magic that's happening behind the scenes for us. Public integer, figure out int, return 3 plus 4. Then it's just compiler value. Well, we already call it task.run, so it's already running, so we don't have to call run. Then it will say int value equals compiler value dot result. So that's shorthand for all of this. Even though figure out it will be something of, F5. Oh, I forgot. I can't type today. No worries. There we go. All right. So it's all shorthand for that. Task.run is shorthand for task.factory.startnew. Anybody here uses task.run? Anybody here uses task.factory.startnew? Anybody here uses both? If you're not using both, use both. And I'll explain that in a second. But that task.run I showed you with the await keyword is shorthand for all of this. And this is still shorthand. We could actually go deeper. We can actually go and do task.continue with and actually get the result after this task is ran. We can break this out even further if we wanted to. But I'm just showing you that there's a lot of magic going on behind the scenes to give you all this syntactical sugar, all this shorthand. Go ahead. Yes, hold on. It's not blocking. You're absolutely right. All right, task.wait. Thank you. If this went to production, I would have been in trouble. I would have been in big trouble. All right. So, again, even better. That's even more stuff that's being obfuscated away from you. So it's really important if you're studying for the C-sharp exam to understand what's being done underneath the hood. Now, a couple other things I want to show you. To risk demo type itis, I'm going to copy two tasks that I have. I'm just going to turn this back to statements. So I have, I'm going to do integer value 1 equals task.factory. That's starting new. I'm going to use the shorthand, task.run. And in here, I'm going to await a delay. So I'm doing an asynchronous delay. I'm going to run that. All right, so that works. And I could just dump this so you can see that it's a real value. I'll dump it to the console. Value one that dump. It took 3.5 seconds. A little bit of change for the actual processing logic, but I mean, it's math. Yeah. Now I'm going to do another one. And I see this so much in production that I want to throw my head against the wall. Value two dot dump. So we're waiting. Queries continuing asynchronously. Da-da-da. Jeopardy theme music. Do-do-do-do. All right, here we go. 7 seconds. So this is something I think that's very important to understand, again, about all these methods available to us in Task Parallel Library. Even though we ran this asynchronously, we actually had to block until this value 1 is returned. And then we blocked again. That 8-week keyword is blocking until that value 2 is returned. So 7 seconds. So this is one of the things where I want to bring up task.wait. So you can actually store the task and then take that task object and say, wait until this is completed. And the great thing about this is if it was completed already, that's fine. So if we, let's say I just took out these delays, by the time we got to the task.waitAll statement, it may have already completed, but that's safe and fine. So that's something you can do, wait any, wait all. We're going to do wait all here. And instead of awaiting this, I'm just going to return that task. So task, sorry, didn't mean to hit that. Demo-itis. And I'm going to wait on both of those tasks. And then once done waiting, value1.result.dump, value2.result.dump. We're waiting. Notice it took 3.5 seconds because it just ran them at the same time. So again, something you want to understand and want to know, you have these waits. You can actually wait on multiple tasks at the same time. If you put A waits after each other, you're waiting on one, then you're starting the other. So that's things that about that task parallel library, some idiosyncrasies that, you know, it's good to know. And if you already knew it, great. Just wanted to show you a couple things. Now, last one, and then we're going to go back to slides. This is my favorite one because I worked with the task parallel library and async await keywords forever and figured this out about 6 months ago. Like, I kind of knew what was going on, but I never really dug into it until I had to deal with it. So notice in this example, within this delegate, we actually used the async keyword because we're going to await something within this delegate, right? So let's say I did task factory to start name, and I awaited that. I want to get my value, right? So I await it because, you know, that's what we do as programmers. We're going to await and hit F5 and waiting on it. Oh, it's returning a task event, not just an end. So they had this method that we could use called unwrap. Where is it? I deleted my example. But test that factory, let's start new. Let me try something else. Test that. Oh, I know what it is. Test.factory.startNew. All right, I will show it to you, but I'm drawing a blank. But there's a method called unwrap that you can use. They'll actually unwrap that inner task so you can just use this directly. The reason I wanted to show you that, and forgive me, demo-itis, is because task.run, and this is the last thing I want to show you. I'm not going to be able to demo it because I completely blanked. It's going to come back to me because I was just running it in a hotel this morning. task.run does that for you. So if you have multiple tasks within your task, task.run will automatically unwrap them for you. And that's a nice behavior. But if you didn't know task.run was doing that for you, it could cause some problems if you actually intended to return a task. So if I ran this directly, got to put my colon. You'll see that it runs, even though I have a task on the inside, because task.run is nice like that. It'll do that for me. Whereas task.factory.startNew will complain because it's really returning a task type int. Task.run is unwrapping that task underneath the hood. For some reason, I can't get the unwrap function to work. We'll just attribute it to demo-itis. All right, back to slide. Concurrent collections. There's a lot of built-in collections in .NET that just give you a concurrency. The concurrent bag is like a property bag. It allows you to access it from multiple threads. Thread-safe collections. Dictionary queue is just the equivalents for the existing collections we know in .NET. And then there's a blocking collection. It's kind of like a base class that you can inherit from and use it in your own collections if you want to make them thread safe. Multi-threading. The thing I did not show is that task.run is shorthand for task.factory.startNew, and it makes some assumptions about what you want to do, like what parameters you're passing in. So understanding that and understanding cancellation is important because it's mentioned by name in ejector domain. Anytime they put something by name in ejector domain, you can guarantee you'll see it on the exam because you're guaranteed everything ejected, every bullet in ejector domain, at least one question. So if they mention something by name, you probably should study it. And guess what? They mentioned task cancellation by name. And so passing a cancellation token to the task, understand what the token source is and how to actually implement that cancellation so you can cancel a long-running task is important to understand. I put thread-safe methods here. I want to bring that up. Ejector domain is very clear on this. You, as a developer, and this is more computer science-y than anything, understanding how to design a thread-safe method is mentioned specifically. Now, they're not talking about any specific .NET, you know, feature or anything like that. It very specifically says understanding how to design a thread-safe method. So just understanding the concepts and some of the things you want to think about and consider when you have a method that's being accessed by multiple threads at the same time. Program flow. Control statements within C#, we know most of them, like the if-thens, the while, do-while, switches, the fors and for eaches. We know most of these statements, so that's great. There's a couple of them that we know of, we don't use as much. And I want to show these link pad real quick. So to start with, let's say I'm doing a for each loop. Anybody ever used enumerable.range? Ooh, I just gave you your new favorite method, our new favorite static method. Enumerable.range, start with 1, and I want 10 numbers. Now just before I do that, I'm going to show you what enumerable.range does. I'm going to dump it. In LinkPad, you can dump things to the console. F5. What does it return? It returns just enumerable 10 numbers. So if you ever just need a set of 10 numbers, there you go. You don't have to do a for loop. Enumerable.range does it for you. Very nice. So we're going to use it. We're going to use it and abuse it. For each integer number in enumerable dot range, start with 1, go to 10. And so we have a for each loop. So you're probably used to like the continue and the break statements. So let's start with Let's start with the continue statement. So understanding the difference between continue and break, which is really useful. So continue is really easy. It just says go to the next iteration of the loop. Do not run anything below this. So in this example, when we get the 3, we're not going to write 3 to the screen. We're just going to go to the next iteration of the loop. Let me call this I. 1, 2, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Break just drops out of the loop. 1, 2, stop. Very simple, very basic, but you'd be shocked how many times I find somebody, people will use break, never use continue. Use continue, never use break. So understanding the difference. Another thing I want to show is yield. Oh, I'm really sorry. Yield's a lot of fun. So LinkPad, you actually build out a console application. In this console application, I wrote a method called power. Pass in a number, pass in an exponent. And what we do is we do a for loop. And I could have done this with enumerable.range. And I'm going to take this breakout first so you can see what it does for real. What it does is just multiply by the number. So it's kind of just continue to multiply that result again and again. And it does yield return. So yield return will actually build a collection for you within the method. So if I run this, you'll see I got 2 to the 8th power down here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Yeah, to the 8th power. Now, yield return you've probably seen before. Yield break is the one I always show in a class when I'm teaching C#. People are like, I've never seen that before. So yield break, let's have fun with this. So I can actually go in here and I can say,
In my method, I want you to never compute anything higher than an exponential of 5. And the reason is because my computer is slow and I don't want anybody to put big numbers in. So if we do yield break, it just stops the whole process. So watch this. If I run this, you got to run the whole thing. You'll see you got to 5 and it just stopped collecting all the values for the loop. So yield break. It's kind of a think of recursion and base statements. It's just really easy way to doing it. So yield break will be your base statement for your recursion. Very interesting. Like I said, see a lot of people do yield return. Very rarely do I see people use yield break. There you go. Then you can go back to the shop and show everybody something new. All right. Callbacks and events. I've seen people do lambdas, delegates. I've seen people use some of the built-in predicate. If you haven't used func in action, these built-in helper delegate classes, use them. They're really, really useful. I mean, just useful in general. But understanding what they are, like understanding the difference between a func, which you know has a return value as the first generic parameter, and action, which doesn't return anything. Just, you know, on that basic level is just really, really important because delegates are, again, mentioned specifically in the objective domain. So functs and actions, predicates. You're going to laugh at this. Like I said, I learned C-sharp academically. So it wasn't until a year ago till I found out what the predicate was. I just was using func and then the first generic parameter is Boolean. I didn't know there was something built in that did that for me. So I found out what predicate was. I was like, oh, that's great. I'm not going to go back and rewrite my code, but, you know, I'm glad to know it's there. But, again, I find people know one and don't know the other, so yada, yada, yada. Anonymous methods, just like you saw me use that lambda syntax to create an anonymous method for my task. Just understanding that syntax, understanding how to do it that way, or just create a delegate using the delegate keyword is important. Subscribing and unsubscribing from an event. I don't know how many times I actually went into, I'm a consultant, so I went to a shop and they subscribed, I see this all the time on Windows forms with WPF. They subscribe to events and they never unsubscribe them, like when the view is destroyed or anything. And I was like, oh, well, you should unsubscribe from an event. They're like, oh, yeah, you know, that makes a lot of sense. How do you do it? It's like, well, you subscribe with plus equals, so to remove it, minus equals. So I no insult to anybody. It shocked me, but a lot of people don't know that you can unsubscribe from an event by using minus equals and in the same reference. So understanding both sides of it. Ooh, example question time. I love example questions. All right, we have an application, communicates with an external service. Now, the code for this application is implemented in a try block. We need a catch block, and we have a requirement that we need to rethrow the exception without losing or changing the call stack, because we want to log these unexpected exceptions. So which catch block will fulfill our goal? Anybody want to guess? B? Any others? Any other guesses? We're unanimous. You're all too smart for me. All right, a couple things I want to bring up before I jump to the next slide. While you can wrap the exception by, you know, throw new exception E, it will change the call stack. So you probably all know this already, but that's something that, you know, when I was a programmer, I found out the hard way. So, you know, by appending that new item, it makes it much worse when you're trying to debug the application to figure out where this exception originated from. throw E, of course, will remove the call, well, not delete, but, you know, will clear the call stack, throw the exception itself, and then throw new exception is just absolutely a waste of time. All right, create use types. Understanding your value types, your structs and enums is important. I'm going to show you something in LinkPad that many people probably seen already, but you'd be surprised how many times I actually shown this demo, and someone's like, I didn't know you could do that. So let's say I'm the worst DBA in the world. And so we're writing application because I'm the worst DBA, and I have a lookup table with millions. Well, no, let's go trillions of records. And I want you to make an enum for it. And you know that you will never open this in Visual Studio ever in your lifetime. You're building this, you know, command line, and you're hating the DBA the whole time. And then just in the middle of creating your enum, and we're not typing this out, heaven forbid. We're actually generating this for the database. But for examples, I'll type it out. So we have a lookup called all magic numbers. I like magic numbers. All right. And magic 1, we'll set that new value to 1, sure. Magic 2, we'll set this a new value to, why a letter get in there? All right. Run this, and we see that can't convert type uint to int. So enums are backed by integer. Probably all know this already. But a lot of, it really interested me. I didn't figure this out until a while, that you can actually change the field that's backing it by just using the inheritance syntax. And so now if I run it, there we go. So you can change the backing field for enum. So again, something you want to know. It helps you understand how enums work so you can be better prepared to answer questions on the exam. That was the short demo. That's the one that always works, because all I have to do is just type in random numbers. Reference types. Understanding your reference types, what they are, the difference between them and value types. Like, for example, well, value types and reference types. And this comes up in every college course, and this comes up in the C-sharp training course. You know, if you create a new instance of a value type, if you create a new instance of a reference type, what are the default values that are populated? Things like that. Understanding those little small differences just will help you be prepared for this exam. Generics. If you're not using generics, shame on you. Use generics in everything. I went through a college program where I learned C-sharp towards the end, but we started with Java. And my professor was absolutely astonished, amazed with generics, and just it's all he wanted to teach. So I was lucky to just learn generics so early, but it just changes the entire way you design applications and the way you think about your software. So you probably, if you're here at Tech Ed, I assume you're the type of developer, you're using the latest and greatest. I mean, you come all the way out here to Houston. So generics, you know, understanding what they are, understanding things like generic type constraints, again, will help you be better prepared for the exam. All right, class members. I don't think I have to go too deeply into this with you all. You know, understand like, you know, the properties, variables, the methods, the different members of a class. I do want to show you a couple things. The main one is extension methods. I'm not going to, you've probably seen this already before, but I just want to show it again. I always like to give this demo. So I'm going to start with static method called extension methods.add. If you know static methods from any other language, you know I can call it 2, 3. And you know what? I'm going to just integer result equals. I'm going to result.dump. I'm just going to dump it out to the screen. Let me zoom in on that. A little control scroll love. All right. So static method. Nothing different here than what you're used to. By specifying this keyword in front of the first parameter, it's now an extension method. And you probably all, again, you probably all seen this before, but it allows you to just go in and extend. And again, this is syntactical sugar. You're not changing the existing class anyway. You're just giving you a little compiler love so you can write a nice little compact and concise code. So instead of doing extension methods.add, I can easily just do, since I know 3 is integer, I can do 3.add 5. And my result is 8. So, you know, a little nice extension methods. Now, we can also do optional parameters. So we can do int on far right, set that to 0. And so this is optional parameters. So my code will work just fine as it is, because I can optionally specify this parameter. So I'm going to add it to my equation. And if you hit comma, you'll see that the IntelliSense will tell you that you can specify this parameter if you like. The square brackets means optional. And understand the optional parameters because they're mentioned by name. The objective domain is important. So I can say 8. You know, 8 plus 8 is 16. F5, get my result 16. Another one is named parameters. The thing is, like, C-sharp is really flexible. So even though that feature was introduced, a lot of people ended up never using it. So just, you know, understanding naming parameters and specifying them out of order. If you do any type of MVC development, you probably have to deal with the reality of named parameters because you don't want to specify 20 parameters to get the right overload of your method. So here, far right, 2, right, 4, and I can specify my parameters out of order. So again, name parameters, optional parameters, and static extension methods all in one demo only at TechEd. All right. Overloading members, just a lot of the same things in any other object-oriented language. You came from Java, you came from VB into C Sharp. It's much the same way, just understanding those basic concepts. On the object lifecycle, iDisposable interface. Understanding not only how to implement it, but the MSDN specific best practice for implementing it. This is one is always a catch. You want to, and this is again mentioned in objective domain, you want to understand the way that's mentioned in MSDN, where you actually implement a dispose method with a Boolean parameter, and you actually call another private dispose method, and then that pattern, and this is I don't have the page up because I don't have Wi-Fi, but this is the MSDN has a very specific implementation of dispose that they consider best practice. If you actually turn on the Microsoft rule sets for code analysis, it will ding you if you implement dispose in any other way. So if you turn on like the hardcore code analysis rules, you'll get dinged really bad for not doing that form of disposal implementation. So I always advise people to just go look at that example. Now, there's two reasons. One is because it's considered best practice. And two, and this is the more important reason, it actually gives you an explanation of why they do it that way. That explanation alone will greatly enhance your knowledge of how the garbage collector and hinting towards the garbage collector works in C#. That one article kind of enlightened me to a couple of different things I never thought of before with the disposable interface. So that's a suggestion right there. Yes, code analysis. I mentioned code analysis kind of briefly. It's not part of this exam, not in objective domain, so you don't have to worry about it. But it's a feature in Visual Studio. apologize again. FXCop. Anybody ever used FXCop? All right. It analyzes. Analyzes your code for best practices, things like casing for member names, casing for class names, implementation of certain methods, following certain patterns. It can get really deep or it can be very surface level. And by default, when you have Visual Studio installed, you have a couple different rule sets that are already built in, and some of them are the actual Microsoft internal best practice rule sets. So you can decide how far down a rabbit hole you want to go. I mean, you can get to the point where it completely re-architect your application based upon the code analysis suggestions. All right, I'm looking at the time I don't want to go over. Class hierarchies. I'm not going to spend long here because I believe we all come from object-oriented backgrounds. So we understand inheritance. We understand base classes in the C# world, understanding the virtual keyword and the abstract keyword. Understanding, why you would use the abstract keyword in the base class, why you use abstract to actually as a keyword for the class itself or a specific member within that class. And this one is the one that surprises people. It mentions in objective domain specific interfaces they want you to know. So that's why I always say go read the objective domain. So it mentions these four specific interfaces that it says you should know these. So iComparable, iEnumerable, iDisposable, and iKnown. So there you go, checklist. All right, another example question. We have an application, we read, and these example questions, I purposefully did them on things that are in the objective domain that are not in the slides, just to have a little bit of fun. Because if I ask you a question of something I just explained 2 seconds ago, you'll probably just throw a shoe at me. All right, we need to combine 100 lines of text. Our business scenario, we read data from a database. Which of these is the most efficient way to combine the different strings? All together now? All right. String builder. String builer, string builder, string builder. All right. If you don't already know, when you concatenate strings or when you manipulate strings, I think the term is immutable. So basically creates another copy of that string to do that operation. So it's always much more efficient to use the string builder class. And I almost forgot, string builders mentioned by name in an objective domain. So, All right, debugging applications implemented security. We're not going to spend a lot of time here because we've got a little bit more demos to do. But understanding different types of encryption available to you, C#, Specifically, understanding the difference between asymmetric and symmetric encryption. This is more theoretical level. The idea of asymmetric encryption got public and private key pairs. You know, understanding when you would use one and the other. With symmetric encryption, the idea of you using a key or in the case of Rheindahl managed, you know, you have an initialization vector, which is, you know, you think of it like a key. And you use that key to encrypt data and unencrypt data. So it's, you know, symmetric. You encrypt and unencrypt it with the same key. Hashing and salting data. This is the one when I teach a C-sharp class, people are like, huh? Hashing and salting data using the C-sharp libraries, you know, the whole concept of you have a password and you can you want to salt it, you know, offset it, and then hash it. And then that way, it's kind of the whole idea of you're hashing it in such a way that you don't ever plan to unhash it. What you plan to do is whenever somebody goes into your web form or desktop form and types in a password, you salt and hash it in the same manner and then compare the result of that with what's stored so that you're never unencrypting your data to verify a user. You know, very secure way to look at it. That's the one that that's what I want to highlight, because that's the one that people are like, oh, that's in the objective domain. I know of it, but I've never done it. Trace. I was going to do a demo for this, but the demo is extremely boring. Trace, you have that system diagnostics namespace. You have the trace class with some static methods, trace information, trace error, trace warning. Understanding how trace works, the whole idea that you separating the concept of logging from storing or viewing those logs is really important, because we all think of logging like maybe we'll write to a text file or something like that. Whereas with trace, it's much, much simpler. We just use those trace static methods, and we trace information, trace error, trace warning. And when we configure our application, we set up a trace listener, where we want that to be a file system, a database, the Windows event log. I've actually done this before, Azure storage tables. You know, wherever you want that data to go, that trace listener is a separate concept. So when you write your code, you're just writing the trace. And you may be logging it. Maybe I'm logging a file system in development, but in production, I'm logging it to a database. You're separating that whole concept of tracing and viewing and managing those trace messages. Building. There's a couple things here. The one I want to highlight really is the whole idea of debugging, understanding how to debug, how debugging works, stepping forward, stepping back. Understanding where those are in the Visual Studio interface, because again, we talked about you may see some interface questions. You know, understanding where everything is in the interface is important anyways. Understanding your different build types. Release and debug is usually the ones you see by default when you open up a new .NET project, but understanding how you can actually create your own configuration, understanding the differences between a built-in configuration, understanding, you know, when you have the release configuration, that even if you're debugging a release configuration, the symbols might not match up 100%, so you might, you know, see an offset. You know, you might be debugging a release build, and you're at this line, you're like, that doesn't make any sense. You know, understanding those concepts. Strong name signing. If you've done a Windows Store app, you probably had to do this just to deploy the app to the store. So it's one of those things that if you've never done it before, hello, welcome, now you're doing it. So the example I always give is if you want to see an example of a SNK file, just open up a brand new Windows Store app. It creates one by default for you. And then that's a really good example. You can go in and see about strong name and signing assemblies. All right, example question. You have a website. We allow users to register new accounts with a username and password. Passwords are hashed and salted in the system. At login, we're going to take one encryption classes, we're going to hash and salt the user-provided password. And then just like we talked about before, instead of unencrypting the password, we're going to verify that that hash matches. Which of these classes can be used to encrypt the password provided at login? So at the login time, which of these classes will we use to encrypt that password? I hear D. Any others? You said A and D? Technically, you can use A, but the requirements required us to salt them before hashing them. And so that's, I probably could have designed this question better. I think I made an error in this question. I went with D because that's the official answer, but Yeah, somebody brought up A. You could technically get around, you can actually technically sort data before you use that algorithm, but SHA-1 is technically considered a symmetric algorithm, not a hashing algorithm. So I could have clarified that question and see now, that's why I don't write for exams. Well, they don't allow people who write for exams to present these sessions, conflict of interest. I write for other exams, not the C-sharp exam. If I was to rewrite this question, I would clarify it by saying you should not be able to decrypt the password. And then that would disqualify it. See, now you're starting to understand what we talk about when we say questions can't be meant to trick you. That question tricked you. So if you ever see a question on the test and you think, hey, this question is tricking me, this question is unfair, you can actually leave feedback. We have someone on Born to Learn, Liberty Munson, who that's her job is to read feedback and disqualify questions. And she does it with a vengeance. And so, and it hurts. It stings when you write a question and she kicks it back to you. So if you ever see a question you think is unfair, leave feedback, because sometimes they even revise your score based upon feedback. It has happened. All right, IO operations. The simple file methods and classes available to you, it's important to understand those, work with those. Read all lines, read line, understand the patterns there, read all lines, we got a string array. Read line, we're actually looping through, doing a do while or while. Write all lines is a pretty simple one. Understanding how to work with files and in memory streams. Memory streams are an important one. We do have the crypto stream that kind of counts towards both ejected domains. It's kind of mentioned in two places in the ejected domain. So crypto stream is probably important one to know. Now, the one I really wanted to emphasize here is the system.net namespace. We had these classes for a while, the web request and web response classes. Now, the reason I bring this up is because a lot of us building applications are now using HTTP client libraries that are available on NuGet. They're incredible, real easy, based on the same thing that Web API uses. But because we're using a really convenient class, we almost skip underneath the hood, the web request and web response, or the HTTP web request and HTTP web response. So if you're using the latest and greatest, you want to take a step back and look at the web request and web response. There's two reasons you want to do this outside of this exam. One is if you ever run into a scenario where HTTP client is not going to work out for you, a good example I'll give. If you build, let's say, a Windows Store, or iOS, and Android app using Xamarin, right? You have to use portable class libraries between the different platforms, right? Portable class libraries don't support the HTTP client NuGet package. You have to go back to web request and web response. Let's say you want to do some real custom stuff. Like, for instance, the HTTP client class is so convenient, right? Let's say I'm posting some data or figure out the content length. Well, what if you have, and this has happened to me in production, I had someone who's developing a PHP backend, great developers, but they decided to have endpoints that I have to post data against with no data. So I have to post against the endpoint, but no body. And that violates everything, HTTP 1.1 spec, but that's how their system works. And so if I use the HTTP client class, the HTTP client class gets confused because it's trying to protect you from shooting yourself in the foot. So I had to go back to the web response and web request classes and understand I can use those so I can manually set content length and manually set the body. So even if you use the latest and greatest, you want to take a step back and use the previous versions. Working with XML. This is the one I always get questions about. There are multiple ways to work with XML. The one is mentioned in injected domains linked to XML. So just understanding, xdocument.parse and be able to do your link queries both to read and generate XML using link. There's tons of articles on MSDN about it. But usually I find you can go in an IT shop anywhere, well, development shop anywhere, and half of the people are really good at reading XML using link, and half the people are really good at writing XML using link, and it never crosses. You very rarely run into somebody who's good at both. Because it's like, I don't know, something left brain, right brain, I don't know. But I'm good at reading XML using link, but I always have to go look up the reference to or write it using a link to XML. The other thing I wanted to mention, the classic libraries, XML Reader, XML Text Reader, XML Writer, XML Navigator, they're mentioned specifically in injected domain. So, if you're like me, you're so into link that you're like, forget all these other classes, you're probably going to want to go back and look at them. Same thing with the web requests. Serialization. The different serialization options that are built into .NET, you're probably going to want to know all of them. Binary serialization, how do you implement custom serialization interfaces you're going to use. The XML serialization, and that's when you start to think about data contracts and XML serialization. And I'm not specifically talking about only the WCF SOAP variant of data contract serializer. There is other variants. Specifically, the data contract JSON serializer. It's new. It's glue. It's mentioned specifically in objective domain. So, you know, there's something. Remember, everything mentioned specifically in objective domain, you should expect to see on your exam. Link. Understanding the different query syntaxes for link, whether you're using the Lambda syntax or the actual query syntax. So let me jump over to the demo machine. So fortunately, I have a database already created. Just has events table for each event. I have a start time, end time, title, description, just some generic stuff. So I can go events, and then hit F5, and I'm going to close this out. I'll see I have a whole bunch of events in this events table, and some lore and some text with a description for each event. Now, I'm going to switch this to, in link, you also have another view, which is the object view. When we have a lot of data, it's really useless. So understanding both of the syntaxes, you want to be fluent in both syntaxes. This is going to sound really embarrassing, but I went through a computer science program, so I took Lambda calculus before I graduated. So when I graduated, that was when link was starting to become big, and so I went straight into the Lambda syntax. So up until about, I'm going to say 9 months ago, I wasn't comfortable in the query syntax. Sometimes I still feel like I'm not comfortable in the query syntax. That's just a natural omission of mine. So I find when I talk to people about link, everybody picks a favorite, and they don't even pay attention to the other. I hope that's not your architect, because then they tell you everybody in the shop is going to use this one syntax and not the other, and then everybody has to learn that one. And then you go to another shop, and you find that they're using the opposite. So that's just how it works. So understanding everything in query syntax, so from E in events, where E dot, let's see, date, start date, or start time, actually. It's greater than date time dot today dot at, this is 2014. So same date in 2016. Select E. Understanding the query syntax, the Lambda syntax. Understanding projection. Select new key equals event key. Oh, sorry, E dot event key. End time equals E dot end time. Understanding projection. Understanding what happens if you project without specifying the name. There's a lot of little things here. Another one to show, projection with the Lambda syntax. So events where E dot end time is end time dot year is less than 2017 dot select. Oh, come on. Select new. Oh. Understanding projection with the Lambda syntax as opposed to just the query syntax. Understanding anonymous types, which came with link. The var keyword, which came with link to make link, make it a little bit more enjoyable working with link. A couple of other things. You also have the other things like group, take, skip. Joins. You actually have your joins from SQL that you're used to. So you can join, let's see, R event. I think it's event key equals R dot. I have a registration table. R dot event key. Select event equals. Come on, be nice. E dot. Oh, I forgot the new keyword. Select new. event name equals e dot. It doesn't like me. Anyways, I'm forgetting something. Oh, equals. You have to use the equals keyword. That's another one. That gets me every time. That's why I hate the query syntax. Sorry, that was really loud. I hate the query syntax. Why do you have to type in equals? Come on, it's C sharp. Be cool. It looks better. I don't like look better. I want work and efficient. That's what I want. And then we have our registration first name plus r.last name. Attendee. Yeah, just understanding projection, understanding joins. Understand how many people ever did two froms in link and saw what happened there. Ah, there you go. This is always fun. From R in registrations, even though it'll be really ugly here. So for every event, every registration, it does kind of a like a cross type thing. Actually, you know what? You know, it'd be an even better example. This is probably not the best example. I know a really good example of this. So I'm going to do new int array, 1, 2, 3. New int array, 4, 5, 6. And then I'll just select the new E and a new R. And it does every permutation for those combinations. So 1, 4, 1, 5, 1, 6. You can already think right now in your applications the way you can use that. Understanding some of the idiosyncrasies in the query syntax, whereas in Lambda syntax, understanding that. And the same thing we talked about earlier, we talked about anonymous methods, all the tools available to you. They're available to you in Link when you use that Lambda syntax. Or technically, I've heard it called the anonymous method syntax. I like Lambda syntax better. It sounds cooler. It looks better on the resume. All right. Deferred query execution. Deferred query execution. If you don't understand deferred query execution in Link, please go look it up. Please go look it up. Because that's the number one trip up thing working on applications. It's mentioned specifically in objective domain. And the whole concept of you can create a query in Link, but it's not that query is not executed until you enumerate over that IEnumerable. Here's another one. Anybody ever created an iQueryable provider before? Okay, not too many. All right, we've got a couple. So understanding that creating an iQueryable provider so you can actually parse those expressions that either come in through the query syntax or come in through the Lambda syntax against your own provider. Maybe you have your own systems. Linked to entities with Entity Framework. A lot of people are like, well, linked to entities, what it does is bring all your SQL entities into memory and it does a link query over them. No, it does not. Linked to entities takes your link expressions. It actually parses them as in-memory expressions. It actually takes your code, if you think about it this way, it takes your code and breaks it into little expressions, right? Then it takes those expressions and translates them to SQL. And the translation engine is good or bad, depending upon what time of the day it is. And then once it does this translation, it sends that translated SQL query to SQL. So that's an iQueryable implementation. Understanding that little nuance will help you out a lot. All right, generic collections. Just wanted to bring those up real quick. You got your list. You got your dictionary with your strongly typed key and a strongly typed value. Your queues and sorted lists, which you know are pretty self-explanatory. You have your stack. Again, self-explanatory. These concepts, you know, come up in computer science classes. Array list, understanding how you can store different types within there. You know, now that you're using array list, you, the client application, are in charge of managing or detecting the types using either is, as, or random algorithm. Whatever you decide to use, like if I know item number 3 is of this type, please don't do that. But if you decide to do that, you're in charge of your own type management there. Generics don't help you. Hash table. Understanding what a hash table is as a concept. Understanding that a dictionary is backed by a hash table. Queues and stacks. Just those generic concepts. All right, example question. We have a service application. We receive JSON data from client devices. We need to deserialize the JSON strings to a predefined type. Which of these classes can be used to deserialize your JSON strings? Any guesses? Anybody for A? B? C? D? Remember, the questions aren't designed to trick you. If you work with this every day, you'll recognize it right away. And then if you work with .NET in general, you can probably infer because you know they actually specify the types, like with the binary serializer, or binary formatter, excuse me. They actually are SOAP formatter. They say in the name of it what type of serialization occurs there. So if you work with the framework every day, you can make some inferences. And I'm not going to run through this example question because we're running low on time. Well, actually, no, I was on the last section. I'm really going to run through the example question. You just all know the answer already. Questions like this, you'll see them all over the internet. Just, you know, example questions playing around with link. In this example, we have some values. We have a threshold. And I just do query syntax from V in values, where V is greater than or equals threshold. Select V. And then I change the threshold midstream. Laser pointer. All right. I didn't even notice a laser pointer on this. All right. Change the threshold midstream. What's returned? And this is that point I made about deferred query execution. Even though we define the query, remember, in link, this lambda or this query syntax, they're just expressions. We're just defining a query. We don't run the query until we enumerate. In this example, we enumerate by calling toList, and then the query is executed. So the query is pointing to a value somewhere else. So in this example, it's pointing to threshold. We can change that value midstream. And so we change that value. And then when we executed the query, we're using the new threshold value. So understanding deferred query execution probably help you out in your applications a lot. But I'm just understanding the whole concept of it. It's mentioned specifically in the objective domain. Resources. All right, this is how you can see it for real. Last time I wanted you to close your eyes. TechNet, Channel 9, always really useful. Microsoft Certification Training, that's Microsoft.com/learning. Remember, I told you at the beginning, you can go there to see the objective domain, and actually you'll list it out for you. So you can print it out. That's my suggestion to anybody looking at taking an exam. You can print it out. We have MCT ambassadors. We're up on the third floor around the certification training area. We're at the desk with the wanted poster. If you're already a Microsoft certified professional, come take a picture of the wanted poster. MCPs are wanted throughout the industry. We want us to come see you. If you have questions about the exam, even if you don't plan on taking it here at Tech Ed, even though I encourage you to take it at Tech Ed, it's 50% off. Even if you don't plan on taking it here, come up. We'll answer your questions. We're happy to talk to you about it. We're happy to talk to you about your career planning, your certification goals. MSDN. MSDN is just rock solid resource. I love the new interface. It's getting better and better. I gave you a couple examples of places you can look at MSDN that will break down certain concepts for you even more. Please, whatever you do, complete an evaluation. We all look at the feedback. We get the feedback. You know, help us make the presentations better. Help us help you. we try to help out as much as we can. We try to do exam crams at as many conferences as we can. So we want to make these as good as we can. So if you want to do an evaluation this session, feel free to scan this QR code. So right on time, right at 9:45. Didn't mean to hold you up so long, but enjoy the rest of your conference. You're halfway there. Have a good morning. Go get some coffee. And I'll be here for a couple minutes if you have questions about the C# exam. Thank you again.